Hello, and welcome to episode 222 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hey, Scott.
I recently chatted with a planning department employee in the city where I live, and I learned that a large chunk of land in our city, which would be an ideal place to build much-needed housing, may contain Native American artifacts or other traces of ancient communities. That got me thinking about how we decide what to preserve and what to use. I realize this is a complex and sensitive topic, but it raises a serious ethical question, at least to me. That is, what are our obligations to land that carries historical or cultural meaning? Many people believe certain places deserve protection, cemeteries, sacred spaces, and historic landmarks, but should that reverence extend indefinitely, even when it prevents land from serving the needs of people living today? If we refuse to ever redevelop land because of its past use, are we honoring the past or are we in fact handcuffing the future? I'll admit, I tend to think the ethical priority should be on the people who are living, those who need homes, jobs, and community spaces now. Rick, I'd be curious if you see things the same way I do.
I think you might be posing a false dilemma, as if it's either preserving the past or taking care of the needs of the living. And I think in most cases, we can do both. There are a few instances where a conflict comes up, where we can't accommodate both needs. But usually, there's many opportunities for building, and there's a very few places that are so historically important or significant. We say, okay, this little tiny area, out of, you know, vast acres of land, this little tiny acre of quarter acre of land, we want to preserve this because there are human remains there, for example, or it was a sacred site.
So I guess maybe where, well, the first question, and maybe you just answered it, is that land, a piece of property, can in fact be sacred.
Well, it can. So can land. So you're asking a very complex question.
That's what I'm here for.
Yeah, yeah. I think what we, in most places where we have, let's say we have native burial mounds in our state of Wisconsin.
Oh, we have lots. Like
we have a lot. We have the effigy mounds, and then we have Indian burial mounds.
Yep.
And I think there's something like 4,000 of them in the state. I think it's appropriate to say those are sacred areas.
I would assume the same way that cemeteries are. Is that what you would argue?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, a burial ground is burial ground.
Right. Yeah. Then there might have been sacred ceremonial sites of past cultures that we want to preserve. In those cases, I think what we're doing is we're really preserving something of historical significance. It might be deemed sacred by ancestors, but not by most people in a society, and I think it's reasonable to make accommodations for that. But there aren't that many places where we say this is impeding our ability to provide adequate housing for a whole generation. The reason we're having trouble right now providing adequate housing isn't because there are a few culturally significant sites we want to preserve. It's because of inadequate zoning and all kinds of public policy going back for decades.
Oh, and I promise to not talk about public zoning because then people will turn the podcast off and stop listening because they find it boring. But yes, I 100% agree that public zoning and public policy, especially at the local level, is critical to addressing and helping fix some of the many housing needs we have across our country. But to stick on the issue at hand, though, you know, I don't have the number, and nobody has the number of how many people have lived on this planet since humans first started living on this planet. But that number is a big number, right? I'm sort of making things up, but I think it's probably true, is that most of those people were buried when they died. And we know that the reason we used to, and still do, bury people when they die is not to get like too gross here, but if you don't do that, like bad things will happen. There are real and present safety issues, especially for people generations ago. You had these dead bodies that you had to put somewhere so they would not make other people in the surroundings sick. And I mean, I don't need to go into more detail than that, right? So we put them underground, and that was like the best thing to do at that time. In the recent past, we've also come up with things like cremation, which was not really, you know, I guess we did. I mean, there was some burning of bodies at one time, but the way we do cremation now is a little bit different and all those things. So I guess, but I guess the point I'm trying to make here in kind of a gross way is that with all the billions of people that have lived and will live on this planet, we'll eventually run out of places to put fresh new people because every place will be a burial ground. I mean, eventually. And yeah, we don't know. We know where some of these burial grounds were because things in the past, like 1,000 years, you can probably tell where things and places and people were buried. But if you look to places like Europe, which I think for many thousands of years was pretty more densely populated than here, I mean, I just don't know how you can avoid things like, and I don't know, I guess, why should it matter that 17,000 years ago, someone was buried somewhere that I guess we can't ever build something there? I mean, that just seems weird to me. And yes, well, we don't know what happened 17,000 years ago, but we know what happened 500 years ago, so we should respect that. I don't know. I mean, when do we like draw that line? And I just don't know, because that's where it was convenient to put a body so it wouldn't infect your village. I don't know why that makes it sacred. I mean, it was just like something you had to do. And I just don't understand. That's a long rant, but I just don't understand why disposal of bodies, especially when so many people believe in things we've talked about in this episode, like souls, the body's just like supposed to be like a container for something that's much greater than that. I just don't understand this whole fascination with where we bury people.
I think it's part of longstanding attitudes about reverence towards the dead that we in our society right now are losing. I think it's appropriate for us to have reverence for the dead and
this their bodies means, though.
Yeah, this is one of the ways in which we show reverence for people is how we treat the dead. Any culture that does not show appropriate reverence for the dead almost always is also very abusive towards people. Those regimes that committed like really notorious human atrocities, we're thinking about the Nazi regime, Stalin, the Maoist resolution, what happened in Cambodia, there was no respect for the dead or many of the living.
100% true. But I don't believe that, because I sincerely think that the house in which I live, and let's just say I lived to be 100 years old and I live in that house for the rest of my life, right? And when I die, I don't want that place to be like some sacred place, even though I spent the majority of my living years there. I hope whoever...
Well, I don't think anybody is making that claim. We're talking about there are burial sites.
No, there are
cemeteries. And we mark those off when we say, okay, these are protected. And...
But in the case I started off with here, though, is that this place in our city, which to me seems like a really good place for development, I don't believe that this city planner told me that there are remains there, that this is just, there's artifacts there. And again, we live close to the Mississippi River, large waterways people settled on. And I think that
there's artifacts everywhere.
There's artifacts everywhere. Yes. Yeah. And I guess and maybe I focused our discussion too much on like burial grounds and where we put the dead. But I mean, there are the now failing shopping mall that's in our city was delayed for a year or two, because when they started digging for that, they found like pottery and again, right along the river and so that like slowed down this whole process because they had to excavate this land out and make sure they got the artifacts out and added to the cost and all this stuff. like you just got done saying, of course that's true, especially in a geographical place like we live along a large navigable waterway, that it's not surprising that we want to live here and that people thousands of years ago wanted to live here. I guess going back to what I was trying to say about my house is that when I die, I hope that somebody else buys my house and likes it and lives there a real long time. And I don't think because I feel that way makes me like share values of the Khmer Rouge. I mean, I just think that we should look to be forward-looking in our society and say, how can we best use this land for the people here today, and just worry a whole lot less about how we're going to disturb some sacred non-burial land where something happened. And again, we're talking a lot so far about like Native American people, but this could be like anybody. Like, well, something important happened here 200 years ago. Well, great. Let's not forget that, but let's like move on now.
Well, I think it's important to distinguish between sites that maybe have a handful of artifacts that are scattered through an area. Where like there might be some arrowheads or spearheads, yeah, or something like that, or pottery, some pottery fragments. That's, you know, fine. You collect those, you try to understand their context. And in areas where you know that there is a wealth of such artifacts, I think we should go a little bit slower because we want to understand a little bit more about the historical context of the place where we're living. In a place, and I'm not familiar, I know the land that you're talking about. I don't know anything about the what's been found there. But say if they found something like a village or something that indicates there might be really important historical knowledge that we gain from a careful excavation of that site prior to development, I would say, yeah, that's probably a good thing to slow down to look at it first.
But that's like going to slow things down, but also add to the cost. And most developers are going to be like, you know, and from what I understand, this particular site, developers have said, you know, we don't want to pay that cost. We can just as easily do that somewhere else. So, yeah, we're just going to take a pass. I understand that. Yeah. But like, how is that useful for people today?
I would say these are always judgment calls. I mean, and is there then, where does the funding come to excavate and investigate with proper kind of archaeological concern? Where does that funding come from? Are we funding that? Is it able to be done?
But I mean, I don't know. But I mean, should we be funding that? I mean, we live in a world that does not have endless resources. I mean, I would, again, not to bring this to an entirely local issue, but like, you know, like a lot of cities are setting our budgets for next year. And like a lot of cities, they had to make some like tough decisions around like library funding and parks and all these things that a lot of cities across our country have to make. I think libraries and parks are important because they are helping people today. And I just don't know or how spending money like unearthing some 1,000-year-old pottery that is probably not too dissimilar from the pottery that was unearthed 50 miles from here is like useful. And yes, if we had infinite resources, fine, do it, whatever, but we don't. And it just seems like that's a unethical, I would argue, choice that we're making.
It depends on how much money is being spent. Well, like these are judgment calls. Well, like how significant is that site? And I don't know. So I think it makes sense is that as development is taking place, when we start discovering certain artifacts, that some determination gets made of like how significant is this place. And I think that's a reasonable response. I don't think that we should put endless resources into it. And I think you're correct that our primary concern must be to make sure that we're providing for the people who are living now, especially that we're providing adequate housing and so forth. But if it's a matter of slight inconveniences to the people who are living today, that we know more about the context of the place where we're living and that we care more about the land and so forth, I think that's important too, because one of the things that happens if we just go ahead and develop that, dig everything up and build on it without paying attention to what might be of historical significance, we've lost it forever. We deprived every future generation from ever looking into and understanding something about the cultures that lived here.
But I mean, if we build 50 homes there, right? Again, if this world and humans are around a million years from now, or even 100,000 years from now, those homes won't be there 100,000 years from now, and they'll have like fallen into the decay, and like those will then become things that people will mull about. Well, should we look at in the year of 2027, they built a house here, I think, and maybe we could learn what kind of air conditioning unit they had. I mean, is
no,
that some...
your argument's out of all proportion, because we have like all kinds of evidence, and we're going to have all kinds of evidence of what this culture is, because we're keeping all kinds of records and so forth. We don't really know much about the cultures that were living here 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago. We know very little about them, and what we know is, because we don't have written records from
them. No, mostly, yeah.
We don't have testimonies, stories, anything like that. And they weren't building in steel and concrete and like in ways, like so much of it was wood and hide and things that rot. And so we have these little tiny fragments and indications here and there of what that culture was like. And so when we have opportunities for actually learning something new, I think we should take it. The value, it's not that the value is priceless, but it's worth something. And so then that's a judgment call. Like, how much is that worth?
Against my better judgment, I'm going to go back to dead bodies for a second. In our city, there is a main road that is named after a former Hollywood director, in fact.
Yeah, named after, was it Edward Losey?
I think so, yeah. Or Joseph Losey.
You can
bring up your Wikipedia page if you want to learn more about him. But it's a main thoroughfare through our city named after Joseph Losey. And along a long stretch of that road is a cemetery. And just what you said is probably true, that we will have maps and we will have documentation that we will know many, 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 many generations in the future that this was a cemetery. And at some point, I mean, I just like know where the cemetery sits. It abuts this main road, homes on the north and south side, and a railroad track on the other side. So it's pretty penned in. I don't know if there's spots available still. Don't know. But eventually it will like reach maximum capacity. And it'll be of a cemetery that's sort of at capacity. And I'm sure there's those all across our country. In your position, though, it sounds like, is that because we have like good record keeping today, and we will probably know for a very, very long time that that was a cemetery, even though it's no longer still being used or being taking in new clients, that it's just like off limits for anything until the earth flames out into the sun, that land is just set aside as sacred land because we chose for whatever reason that would be a good spot to make a cemetery, that's just it. And that's just, we're done with that land forever.
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Why not? I mean, and if there are some reasons, if say our survival is dependent on occupying every square inch of land, mm-hmm. and we can't live without that, mm-hmm. I would say that's a different set of considerations.
But like I'm not
but
saying.
But for now, like the reverence for the dead, because like most of us are, cremation is an acceptable alternative now, and a lot of people are being cremated. We're not taking as much room with dead bodies anymore.
Correct.
And I think there is something to be said, like with the growth of the human population, we can't be filling up all of our land, right, with cemeteries. Absolutely correct. But
100 years ago, that's all they had.
That's what they had, and they didn't perceive the problem of not having enough land because there was all kinds of it. There was sort of a compact that they were making with one another, and I think with future generations, that this land be kept intact in memory of those who are buried here. I think it's important that we honor that. It's kind of a promise that we've made to them.
But I want to be clear. I don't think that if this cemetery runs out of new sites next month, that 5 years from now, we should start planning a strip mall across it. I'm talking like 1,000 years in the future, right? Or some place where there's like, and I just come.
And it could be, I mean, something, I could conceive of something would happen where that land was absolutely necessary for survival. And then they'd want to relocate the remains, something like that. But
not, what, a thousand years, there's nothing to relocate, Rick.
So I don't, but that's so far removed from our concerns. I just want to say, like, for ourselves and for anything we imagine in the foreseeable future, that land is off limits.
But, yeah,
and I think that's appropriate.
But I say a thousand years, and it seems like, well, gosh, I don't know. That's a whole long ways from now. But I would imagine, and I could check, and I should have, but a lot of these burial mounds that we're talking about earlier might be a thousand years old, right? So, I mean, it's not like that's something that can certainly, it's not a ridiculous amount of time in the grand scheme of the arc of this world. And I don't know. I guess my position still remains that people and memories are sacred. I just have a hard time believing our land is sacred.
Yeah, some of the burial mounds in Wisconsin date back 2,500 years.
Yeah, so
those are the conical ones that like the effigy mounds. I'm not sure how far those are. The ones that are in the shape of different animals and birds and things. Those don't date back 2,500 years, but maybe like 1,000 years or 1,500. Yeah. They date back quite a ways, but I think they should be respected.
I think a lot of this, and I'm sure many people, because I realize this is an unpopular view I'm talking about here to a lot of people, but many people listening to this probably are saying to themselves, well, you don't understand that the spiritual, the, you know, just because I feel a certain way does not mean everyone should feel that way, right? Is that just because I don't value land as sacred because my ancestors once lived there, once died there, once were buried there.
But like you keep twisting the argument back to saying that I think it's sacred just because somebody once lived there.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that.
No, but I think some people might. Yeah, okay.
I think very few people would say that.
Okay,
like,
fair enough.
Yeah, because of all this land, somebody once lived here.
Yeah, true.
So that's different.
But there certainly are, you know, when you talk about burial grounds, I mean, there is undeniably some sort of religious component to that these people had. And frankly, I mean, you know, this is not just something that Native Americans would attest to. I think there are many Christians who would feel like their cemeteries and you don't use the word graveyards anymore, do we? But cemeteries are sacred.
I like the word graveyards, but by the way.
But that is sort of one of the places where our laws really do respect those religious beliefs, right? Is that, you know, as I was thinking about this, you know, I'm smart enough to know that in the Bible there are 10 commandments, and one of the commandments that came to mind was honor your father and mother. And I think that's probably a good thing to do, right? But and I'm sure not everybody does that. And I think there's people who probably think that we should do more of that, but we don't have like laws around honoring your father and mother. I mean, we just don't. I guess maybe that's a clunky way of asking the question, why do you think we do have policies in place that kind of protect these religious beliefs of a wide swath of people to protect these lands in real ways? Again, mostly talking now about like burial grounds and such, because is that just because those beliefs are so widespread and are so popular, I guess, that to do otherwise would just be you'd be run out of town?
I think it's the wrong way to phrase it to say that the laws are protecting the religious beliefs.
Okay.
I think people are free to believe what they wish. But when you have people believing something, say that they believe that they owe a duty of honor or respect to those who have passed, and we deserve to set aside a place in our lives, a place for them, for honoring their memory. I think that's important to do that, and I think that's what our laws do. So our laws are an expression of the belief, and widespread belief that we have, that we should honor the memory of the dead. But I don't think the laws are protecting the beliefs. The laws are an expression of these widespread beliefs. And then I would just go ahead and defend the belief and say, and I think it's right. So I don't think like you should respect what I'm saying because it's my belief. I think you should respect it because what I'm saying is right. We ought to We ought to pay honor to those who have passed, and we ought to do it in a way that costs us something.
Well, so that last point was interesting to me, because my first thought was that, yes, we all know people in our lives, family members and otherwise, who we care deeply about, who are now dead. And we remember them in ways, especially as we approach the holidays. That's a time where we often have memories about family members we gathered with and some who are no longer with us. And I think it's right and appropriate to think about them, especially this time of the year. I don't know how you could argue against any of that, personally. Again, just going back to our podcast of a few weeks ago around the soul, it just seems like our bodies are such a small part of that. And I would almost think that the more religious you are, the more you believe in a higher power, the more that you think grandma's not lying 6 feet under the oak tree, but is in everlasting life, that you should care so little about where you put a body. And that you should, and that our lives are so much richer, our souls live on, that's who the person truly is. I guess I'm just surprised that we still hang on to those physical touchstones as much as we do.
It's a way of marking in our world the presence that people used to have in our lives, and like indicating like there's some respect in which they are still present to us so that they aren't forgotten. We do this especially with people that we are especially indebted to, and we don't want to forget our indebtedness, so we construct war memorials. If you've been to the Vietnam Memorial, the wall
is
really powerful with all the names. That was very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
It takes up prime real estate. Is there any reason for doing that? And I would say yes.
Yeah,
it's worth, like, those to whom we are greatly indebted, it's important to remember them, and it's important to remember them in some way that's embodied. Because if it's just like in our minds, if it becomes imaginary and ethereal, and you say it's easy to forget about it, but if we put a marker out in the world, what we're saying is this will remind us of the sacrifice that they made and how important it was to us. But it's the same thing when we put out a marker in a cemetery for a person that we loved. And this is one of the things I love to do, by the way, is visit cemeteries when I go to some community and just take a walk.
Where there's no one you know.
No one I know. And just walk and read the gravestones. And what is written on them is really touching. What happens, I walk through a cemetery, and I'm just filled with gratitude for how much love you see expressed there. And it's embodied. It's right there in front of us in a way that it's easy to forget if it's not there in the world, if we cover it up. I think what happens to us in such a case, we become much more superficial. Then we only become concerned with, like, whatever is going on in our lives, you know, like what we ate, you know, when's the last time we had a good bowel movement, whatever is like going on in our lives. We're just concerned with all these different things that are, and this kind of grounds us again and says, like, what's really important in our lives? What's important is our relationships to people and the fact that our lives are really ephemeral. They're here today and they're gone tomorrow, and we don't know when that end is coming. I know that I'm not here for very long. I just hope somebody remembers me, you know, like, and that kind of desire not to be completely forgotten, I think is important, and we show our respect for that.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, what is your question for me this week?
So, Scott, a few weeks ago, I visited a new park near Minneapolis. There's a small playground in the park. It's mostly trails and things like that, and there's a visitor center. But there's this little tiny playground that just has a couple of plastic slides built into a hill. They're not very big. And then a few kind of ground obstacles for children to climb on. There's also a large sign enumerating the many rules for the playground. The sign is about as large as the slides. The rules prohibit many of the activities children routinely do in playgrounds, like going down the slide together, climbing up the slide, and playing tag. I was really surprised by this. So I was just wondering, like, if you had the task of supervising some small children on that playground for an hour or so in the afternoon, would you go ahead and let them do those things, or would you stop them if they wanted to play tag and say, no, you can't do that, it's against the rules?
So my choices are to either let them do these things if they're doing them and not say anything, or if they start doing these things, tell them to stop because it's against the rules.
Yeah.
I'm going to pick a third one. Encourage them to do some of the things on the sign and maybe take a picture. I mean, you sent me a picture of this, and I'll just, you know, they really seem to be obsessed with slides, which does make me wonder why they even playgrounds could be many things, right?
Yep.
But they chose to put slides in. Slides do not just grow organically out of the ground, but there's so many rules about slides.
And I want to emphasize, these are the modern kind of plastic molded slides that are so much safer than the old metal slides.
Like climb up and there was like hardly a railing and those could be legitimately dangerous, but this is not.
And it was usually asphalt at the bottom of them and you could fall 10 feet.
And we're not talking that at all.
No, and they're even built into the hill, so you can't really fall that far. If they fall, it's a couple feet.
So the rules around the slides: one person on a slide or a ride at a time, slide down feet first, no climbing up slides. And then it also talks about no pushing, shoving, or tag. I thought the tag one, I just like...
What's wrong with kids playing tag?
I think the good thing about tag is, other than it gets kids outside and active, is that you don't need equipment, right? Like, you know, oh, I forgot to bring my football, or I forgot to bring a baseball and a bat, or all these things, or a kickball to kick around. I mean, maybe you don't have those things with you that day, and like tag, that's what makes tag great. And like, I just don't, so are those other, can you imagine if like you brought your 7 or 8 friends together with a football and played tackle football? I mean, that, I assume that's like a felony.
That's so bad it's not even listed.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, yeah, and then it does talk about another one that I guess I have a question, because of course I wasn't at this park with you, but many parks have it's obviously mostly grass, it's like, you know, whatever, but where they're like paved sidewalks through the park.
There are some, and then.
So apparently, according to the sign on those paved sidewalks through the park, you cannot be on a skateboard, skates, or on a bicycle. That also seems weird. Yeah, of course.
There's a lot of trails that start at the park and go through the park, and you can have a bike on some of
them. But I would think if you're like, you live near, let's say, are there homes nearby this park?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yeah.
So like, let's say you live across the street and you have like, I don't know, 4 or 5 year old, is that how old kids are when they first start to ride a bike or have the training wheels or take the training wheels off around that age? That you might think, gosh, I have a small yard, or I live in kind of a busy street. Let's go to the park and put the kid on the bike and try it with the training wheels. And maybe we'll even try taking the training wheels off. And you know what, Rick? The kid might even fall off the bike, but no, that is prohibited.
So I'm interested in your first response. So you said you would encourage them to break the rules.
I might.
I mean,
it's obvious. Yeah,
so
yeah.
Let's say the kids are old enough to read.
Yes.
But just old. And they read the sign and they say, but Uncle Scott
says,
what do you tell them?
I mean, I would say that you're at a park, and I don't want you to do something you don't want to do, but please know that whoever wrote this sign is not someone who I don't even understand kids very well, but understands kids less than me and cares more about these rules that somehow, I'm guessing, an attorney helped them write. And please, if you want to do any of these things, please go and do so. Don't let the sign stop you. I'm guessing the slide is not designed for an adult my size, but I would be tempted, if it were, I'd be tempted to do some of them myself.
Like climbing up a slide, that was one of the things that we did all the time as kids.
Oh, sure.
Now, I'm wondering here, Scott, if you think this is mainly to protect them, so this is a liability issue, so if kids get hurt, they can say, yeah, but they got hurt, but we had these rules, or is it a generational thing? You think
younger parents... Oh, I think those go hand in hand.
You think they do?
I think they do to an extent, but I think a few things. The other thing we should point out here is, and this is, it says another rule, is by park district ordinance. So this isn't a separate part of the sign. Like, there's no ordinance apparently in this particular city about playing tag. So we should be happy about that. But it does say, particularly by park district ordinance, children 10 or younger are required to be supervised by a responsible person. And you know they are serious, Rick, because the words responsible person are capitalized. So that's also, that's what, fifth grade? I don't think when I was a kid, I don't know, did we have rules about how old you had to be at a park by yourself? But apparently this particular municipality sets that age at 10. I don't know. That seems a little old to me, but what do I know? But we all know, to get to your question about, is this like a generational thing, that you read stories all the time about, like, an 8-year-old walking 2 blocks to visit his friend down the street, and, like, somebody calls the cops because they think a kid's on the loose and is, you know, running away from home or gonna do some awful thing, and they're just, like, going around the corner to see their friend. I mean, that's, like, not good. And these sort of things, I think, reinforce this approach that everything is a dangerous situation.
We're living in a time where we really are more aware of the dangers to kids from not spending enough time outside, yes, and not spending enough time socializing. It seems like counterproductive to the effort to encourage more kids to put all these restrictions on them when we build a place for them to play.
And I think what is good, and I do want to stress this, is, you know, whether it's on online, you'll see these memes about, like, oh, look at, you know, kids today are just wimps, because when I was a kid, they had these, like, 20-foot slides without railings or these merry-go-rounds on asphalt and all. And, like, I would argue, and people are like, we survived that, you know, so kids today should, you know. No, I mean, I would push back on those every time that, yeah, I mean, most kids survive that. But, like, I know my sister was on one of those merry-go-rounds when she was a kid and fell off and broke her arm, and it kind of ruined her summer.
Sort of thing happened a lot.
A lot.
Those merry-go-rounds were terrible.
Yeah, and it didn't ruin her life.
And the, like, jungle gyms.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it is absolutely a good thing. And I wasn't at this park you were at, but I am almost certain, by the way you describe it, that the people who plan parks today, the people who build parks today, have all those safety measures in mind. They have that sort of soft, spongy surface that's not asphalt. You don't have these 20-foot tall metal slides. You don't have these dangerous merry-go-rounds. I think, like, doing, like, the engineering of these parks has gotten much better, and I think that's all for the better. I don't think we should go back to, like, 1972 playground equipment. That's bad. But I think the people who designed those parks know is what you put in the park is going to be used, and they probably think of, like, what's, like, the worst case scenario for how kids can use this? So we'll try to make it safe. I think all that is smart and good and great. But taking it a step further and saying, like, even though we've engineered really safe, responsible playground equipment and nice open fields for kids to run around in, we still think we need further laws, or maybe not, like, these aren't laws, but rules to govern behavior. That's just all nonsense.
Okay, so just a summary here is, like, the message is, okay, kids, Uncle Scott says, go ahead, break the rule. You don't have to pay attention to the park officials. Break the rules.
It does mention there's an ordinance about the 10 and older thing, so I may pay attention to that because I don't want to get in, like, legal trouble. The rest are just unenforceable rules.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is a case where I agree with you. Instead of spending, I don't know, that it's a really nice, beautiful sign. Instead of spending, you know, I don't know what it was, you know, $5,000-$10,000 on the sign, they could have put in one more, like, children's play thing in that park and made that a little bit better.
And that, yeah, and I think you also agree with me that it's good that we have safer equipment than we did 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, so that we can, yeah, so I think we're on the right side here.
Yeah, I lost a lot of skin off my tongue when I looked up a jungle gym in January. That was painful. There was no sign saying, don't stick your tongue on the jungle gym.
And nobody standing around you when you did that thought that one day he is going to be have a doctorate in philosophy. Nobody thought that at that moment, I'm guessing.
No, but if they would, they would have thought, yeah, that's predictable. Somebody doing something entirely impractical that everybody warned him not to do.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And when you're not hanging around public playgrounds, be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics, and that can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for listening.
Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at freestylelibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit myfreestyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, or prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.